Kevin Leong Aipopo is a community advocate, storyteller, and student leader based in traditional Kalupuya Confederate Tribes of Grand Ronde and Atfalati lands, Beaverton, Oregon, in the United States of America. Their work centers around the intersections between their ethnic identity as a Black American and Samoan person and their gender fluidity. Kevin uses their platforms to interrogate systems of power, challenge normalcy, and uplift voices within their communities. Through interpersonal connection, community organizing, poetry, and education, they have found space as an emerging voice for Black, Indigenous, queer, trans, and climate liberation. Talofalava and good morning, or is it evening on that side of the globe, Kevin? Thank you so much for making time for us.
Talofalava, thank you so much for having me. It's afternoon here, so I think good morning, good evening, in both works. Happy Rotsuma Day.
Good afternoon to you. Kevin, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where were you born and what were the major journey, the forks in the road that you made a decision to turn down for you to be in the space where you are now?
My grandmother is from Halifa in Samoa. My grandmother is from Pono. My parents met in Tacoma, Washington, is where I was born. Both sides of my family have a deep lineage in militarism. I come from a military family on both sides. And I think that really pushed me to be critically engaged from a young age. I had to understand, you know, why my family looked different, spoke differently, the different nuances of how they interact with my dad because he's Black, and also just our positioning. Right, we're around some different people who remove power from us. It really pushed me to try to become an advocate for change.
Wow. Yeah, tell us about that dynamic, because more and more of our Pacifica community, and especially the Samoan community, is part Black. Rock, the Dwayne The Rock Johnson being the most famous of those. How is it that you navigate that path, Kevin?
Yeah, it can be really difficult, I think. For myself personally, I found a lot of comfort in trying to fully embrace myself at all times, while also acknowledging that I present very heavily as Samoan. A lot of people see me, they see a Samoan person only. And because of that, I have to be aware that I don't have the same experiences as, say, my sister, who looks Black, right? Most people can't tell she's Samoan at all. And even within our family and our communities, we've had to do a lot of work to break down a lot of the anti-Blackness that has existed. We love our Samoan people and culture, but a lot of things have happened in the past to make it so the relationships, especially here in the U.S., between Samoans and Black Americans can be tense at times.
Yeah, because we seem to celebrate the Samoan-ness of our Black Samoan community when they succeed in things like American football. Suddenly it's, yay, he is Samoan. But there are those other dark parts that, pardon the phrase, that we Samoans have that you are probably more aware of it, as you've just said, with your own siblings, that you do sense that there is the racism within Samoans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that has been present in my life. And I think my siblings and I, and a few of my cousins who are also Black, have really taken it upon ourselves to not call out my family, but call them and welcome them and help them understand that some of the pieces of what we consider cultural or normal are rooted in really problematic things and are rooted in things that aren't Samoan, right? Like it wasn't Samoan people who who decided to have these perspectives in racism, right? It's something that was pushed onto us and that we've accepted. But now we have the room, especially as you say, we have so many people who are Black in Samoa. You have the room now to celebrate them in all that they are.
And you yourself, with the recent Black Lives Matter movement, were you able to participate in that? And did you feel, presenting Samoan, that you were able to move into that space? Or did you have to be aware, always aware of the fact, into that space, the fact that you do not look Black?
I was able to partake in a lot of the movement, being so close to Portland, Oregon, which is one of the largest spaces where the protests were happening pretty consistently through last summer. I was exposed to a lot of police violence, but also a lot of like community strength. And one thing that's interesting is, like, while I do look very Samoan, especially to people who are Pacifica, like other Black people see that I'm Black. And in the United States, Samoans and Pacific Islanders at large are really underrepresented. And so through ignorance, people prescribe a lot of Samoans or Tongans or other folks as Black because they don't have an understanding of who they could be. And so I think entering those spaces, I do acknowledge my privilege, recognize that my skin is lighter, my experiences are different, and more so that the fight is about the liberation for Black folks. And I don't need to be at the forefront of it or the centered voice, but rather that I have privilege in who I am and where I am, that I can use that to support other folks.
Now, the recent case where the policeman was found guilty, I mean, for me, from a distance, I just felt like, for once, a policeman was going to think twice about taking a life because they have been found guilty, because so many cases that had been taken of police being charged with murder or taking of a life, they've been found innocent, and that has just allowed the mistreatment, if not the killing of Blacks, to continue. How did that judgment reverberate among the community where you were on the ground there?
I think it was a very short-lived celebration for several reasons. I think one, a lot of folks have the understanding that accountability is not justice, and that just because the officer was charged doesn't mean that the system as a whole is going to change, but rather that they're going to take this as a one example to help folks keep quiet. And also at the same time of the verdict, Makia Bryant, who was a 15-year-old Black girl, was killed by police in another state after she called the police in order to be protected. And, you know, she was in an altercation with some adults and needed protection from the police, and they showed up and murdered her. And so it's a very common occurrence, and you can't take the one ruling of Derek Chauvin as like a victory, right? Especially when it's so present and so common. There are so many systems in the United States that protect qualified immunity for police officers, and a lot of their training encourages this sense of superiority and violence and power. And it's something that needs to be stopped before we have to reach a courtroom.
Becoming a poet, what was it that motivated you to write?
Storytelling has always been a large part of my life. I've always taken a lot of pride in oration and speech. Being someone, you know, we have a very large history of oration. It's also something that's really deeply valued in Black American, especially in the South. And so I've always wanted to be a storyteller and incorporate those gifts from my ancestors. But it wasn't until 2018, when I was in Sydney, Australia, for a Pacific Climate Warriors training, that I met with some other folks, and they encouraged me to write poetry. We're going around talking about hobbies, and I said I write, and folks were like, "What do you write?" And I just sort of haphazardly said poetry, just to give a response. And then I was like, "Oh no, now I'm gonna have to become a poet." And I think it really afforded me the room to creatively express some of the deep feelings and thoughts that I was having, because I think critical ideas can only go so far in bringing humanity into the work.
Yeah, absolutely. But obviously, that idea of poetry must have been there for you in your mind, if not in your heart, for you to have said it. You just gave it voice. And then that gave you the impotence. Because it sounds to me like a lot of poets write their poetry, but they just are too scared to read it out loud. Was that a case with you, or did you only start writing poetry when you voiced the fact that you were a poet?
Yeah, I only started writing when I voiced the fact that I'm a poet, and I think I have a lot of experience with public speaking. Here in the U.S., speech and debate is like a sanctioned activity, like almost like a sport. I managed to participate in that through high school and a little bit in college. And so I had done a lot of formal speaking and different poetry interpretations, where we bring together different poems to make an argument. And I think I already had that sort of experience in those areas that allowed me to find space as a poet. But yeah, I really do love to read my work and to share my work. And it's something that I think is always informed by oration. When I write, I write it to be read aloud and not on a page. I'm sort of balancing what it looks like to keep pieces written.
Who are, what are some of the issues that you cover in your poetry?
Mm-hmm. Some of the largest themes in my poetry are surrounding toxic masculinity. My dad is a very rough person. So have my uncles and my grandfather and a lot of people in my life. And it's taken a lot in my personal journey to reorient what my understanding of being a man is, especially as somebody who is non-binary or gender fluid, and my relationship to that masculinity. So that's something that shows up really often. And I also talk about the ocean, right? I think the ocean is some tied into our identity as people, and it brings up so much feeling and so much depth in my work. And often when I write of the ocean, I think of my grandmother, and that's one of my biggest inspirations, is just thinking of her memory and wanting to make her proud with everything I do.
Toxic masculinity. Boy, you couldn't be more masculine than being in the armed forces. How have you negotiated your fluidity with your father?
It's not a conversation we've had. To be transparent, my father is currently incarcerated, and that's been a very common theme throughout my life. And we don't have a strong line of communication because of that. And I think also a lot of my understandings of toxic masculinity were learned from him. And so part of my unlearning process was renegotiating our relationship in ways that felt safe and good for me, because I know that how I hold myself and who I am is not something that he approves of. And I don't feel like it's my responsibility to fight for that approval.
How has mom been?
She's wonderful. I love mom. She's so happy and understanding. And I think she has a lot to learn, as we all do, but always with an open heart and open arms. And I think it's a conversation we started a few years ago, very recently in my life. And her immediate reaction was, I love you. I love you. And yeah, this is who you are. And it's really reassuring and so wonderful to have her.
And the grandmother that you speak of that inspires you to write about the ocean, did you spend some time with your grandmother?
Yeah. So my grandma moved from Falefa to Bangabango in the 70s, and then in 75 moved to Oahu, and then in the 90s moved to Tacoma, where I was born. So all of my life she was around, and I got to spend a lot of time with her, and very wonderful. Being honest, I don't speak very much Samoan. It was very hard to keep the language, especially since the rest of my family, my aunties and uncles, live a few hours away from where we are, so it's hard to keep up. But there was always a deep understanding between us, right? Even if we didn't speak the same language, we understood each other and felt each other. And even though she passed in 2016, she's very clear in my memory. And we visit her all the time. We talk with her all the time. And as I enter spaces like this, I always pray with her before I come.
Now, you're the second person that I've interviewed on this radio station where all pronouns are used. Just for the education of our listeners, why do you choose to use pronouns?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for myself personally, I feel that I have masculine and feminine identities that interact in really deep ways. And it wasn't a realization I had until someone asked me, like, what are your pronouns? And before that, I think everyone had prescribed me as man or as boy. And there's a part of myself that feels very much like that's true, but it doesn't feel all-encompassing to who I am. And so there are pieces of who I am that aren't just feminine in nature, but in essence. And I think incorporating that and speaking truth into it by using all pronouns is a way for me to reclaim those pieces of myself, both in a way of healing and in a way of defiance.
What is it that has given you the strength to and the resilience to be who you are for the sake of those who may be listening and struggling with their own fluidity?
I think there are so many things, but the biggest that I always want to acknowledge are my partner and my cousins. I think my partner was the first person to really validate my identity and recognize who I was in a way that was encouraging and felt free and safe. And I come from a large family, as all Samoans do. And many of my cousins are exploring their own gender and sexuality. And I have a position in my family that affords me a lot of responsibility. And I feel responsible for holding safe spaces for them. For folks who are out there listening and they feel nervous about encompassing this identity, I want them to know that those are valid feelings, right? It can be scary, especially in our communities, to come forth with who you are, but it doesn't in any way make you less than who you are.
And finally, we were supposed to be talking about the Pacific Island Students Alliance, and we're quickly running out of time. I would love to talk more about your life and your experience, but yes, we better end on Pacific Island Students Alliance. Tell us a little bit about that and the conference that's coming up in 2021, Kevin.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Pacific Islander Student Alliance is a group that works to support Pacifica students in higher education between the states of Oregon and Washington in the United States. And so it began in 2007 with Ricky Russo Porotisano, who I believe was on the show not too long ago.
Yes.
But Mac is a really great influence on the work, and I believe he says that a lot of his inspiration for it came from the fact that in the U.S., when there were Pacifica spaces at colleges, everyone was focused on doing luau, right? They're like, oh, we're going to do a luau in the spring, make money for the club and do it again. But there wasn't this critical engagement about our identities, our spaces, what it means to be in this place. And Mac really wanted to foster that space, and so did other folks. And through that vision, we've created a conference. This year, digitally, I haven't been as much in the process as I was last year, but this year, digitally, there are 8 workshops that are happening Tuesday and Friday evenings here in the U.S., and they're exploring different things on identity, climate justice, just sort of what it means to live in the U.S. diaspora as a Pacifica person.
And for people who might listen in on this podcast from the Oregon, how can they get more information, please, Kevin?
Yeah, there are several Facebook pages that you can head towards. So there's the Pacific Islander Student Alliance Facebook page, and also the Pacific Climate Warriors Portland page. I think it's PDX, which is like our airport tag. And both of these organizations work to serve Pacifica youth in the region.
A poet, activist, Pacific Island Students Alliance representative, community advocate, and leader, Kevin Leonga Aipopo, thank you for your time. Thank you for your vulnerability, and thank you for being who you are.
Father Taitele Lava, I was so grateful to be in space with you, and thank you for holding it with such grace and love.
Yeah, Father Taitele Lava. That was poet activist Kevin Leonga Aipopo talking to us all the way from Oregon, United States of America. You're listening to